Today is Thursday. It's March 18th, 2021, the best year ever. Hi, this is John Williams. You know what? It's not the best year ever. Your Honor, I'd like that stricken from the record. 2020 sucked, and the first part of 2021 wasn't good, but it is getting a little bit better, but I digress. It's 1:38 in the afternoon, and this is the Mincing Rascals. It's the podcast we record each week throughout Chicagoland on Zoom. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the wet-ass pundit from the Chicago Tribune. I have three columns a week in the newspaper.
All right, let's start here, guys. Could the Trump Tower Loretto Hospital story be this simple? It's the story the hospital CEO says is the truth. 72 mostly black and brown employees at the former president's nameplate downtown were given the vaccine by mistake. CEO George Miller says he thought as hospitality workers they had elevated status and were eligible for the vaccine, but they were not. Lori Lightfoot later said, "We have a finite amount of vaccine in the city. We've been really, really careful to make sure that we're using it in a way that prioritizes the most vulnerable people who are most at risk and most at risk of spreading it. We just cannot have something like this happen again." And the Loretto CEO said it won't. So nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
So I think there are two things happening here. One, it's the Trump name, which makes everybody a little bit crazy, for better or for worse. The second thing is that the city's supply of vaccine has been so limited and so heavily regulated as in terms of distribution that people, I think, are frustrated about when they can get the vaccine, when they can get it, when they're eligible for it, and how to find an appointment. And that sort of brought everything up together. Mayor Lightfoot and the entire city has been trumpeting Loretto Hospital as the exact sort of perfect partner for this vaccine distribution. Loretto is a safety net hospital on the far south side. 90% of their staff has been vaccinated, which is much higher than other hospitals in Chicago. The explanation that the hospital leadership did not understand the city's vaccine eligibility rules, I don't know how to respond to that. It might not be scandalous, but it certainly triggers my reporter spidey sense when you have a wealthy hospital executive able to redirect a group of vaccines to a place that he lives.
I would react with the vuvuzela of skepticism here. How far away is Trump Tower from Loretto Hospital? So what?
It's on the far west side, and it's about, I don't know, 6 miles. And I was trying to sort of give them some kind of a break, as in sort of looking through the prism of people who have been asking me, everyday people, am I eligible, and having to send them sort of the Tribune links. You know, why is the city, why are the city rules different from the state rules? Well, because we have more people, and thus we don't have enough vaccines to sort of advance at the same pace as maybe the rest of the state. But I just don't see how they couldn't, how this isn't a favor. The CEO, COO, I believe, lives in that tower.
He's got a $2 million unit in there. But
yeah.
But Lisa, the favor is to whom? Because it wasn't the residents that were getting the vaccine.
That's where I kind of go back to sort of less skepticism, though I'm hearing from teachers. That's almost solely who I've heard from. Like, how is it possible that they can somehow set this up? The hospital can set this up at Trump Tower, and yet the city can't sort of set up, which they actually have, something for teachers to quickly get in.
And how does Loretto Hospital, as Heather asked earlier, pointed out, how do they not know the rules? They are the premier hospital for vaccines in the city, and they make that big a mistake on who's eligible?
Maybe they should know, Eric, but did you know? Because if you had asked me, hey, did the person that cleans the hotel rooms or cooks the food at the restaurants, are they 1B plus? Are they ahead of you and me in the line? I would have said, sure they are. They should be right after healthcare workers by teachers. I didn't know that they weren't included.
I think they should be, but John, neither you nor I are in charge of vaccine.
Understood. Fair enough.
And if you asked me that question, I wouldn't just wing it. I would reference it. That doesn't make any sense at all. And why they would go, if maybe they had said employees from Trump Tower can come to our hospital, or are we going to give them but they went to Trump Tower. That, I mean, this is just, yeah.
If this had been the Hilton, is it the same story?
No.
Well, why not? It's a hotel. It's privileged.
Because of the Trump name.
Okay. But I think that's my point then, isn't it? So really, this is just, you don't like Trump, and we're going to go ahead and bust Trump Tower because of the word Trump. When in fact, if this was some other hotel making sure that its frontline workers got the vaccine, we would say good on them. They're protecting those people.
If their chief was a COO, if their COO lived in the hotel, it would still be a story. The Trump name makes it a much bigger story. Well, I mean, we can just be honest about that. But if there is this other connection, it's like, well, why the Trump Tower? Well, you know, if the COO lived in the Hilton, then it would be the same sort of thing. It just would be a smaller story because it doesn't have the Trump name on it.
We got notes as essential workers, but I think that the bosses who put this out did not realize which part of the essential worker program we were part of, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there have been lots of questions about, wait, which essential workers can get the vaccine now and when? And you see that there's a portion right now that who are eligible and a portion that will be eligible depending whether you're in the city or the state coming
Lisa,
up
were
here.
You told that you were an essential worker?
Yes, we were.
I've been told both that I was and then that I wasn't. The last communication I had was that now I'm not. Is that the same with the Tribune people?
How can you not? You're in media. I mean, the category is media.
So the issue is that there are two categories under the state's rules. One is frontline essential worker and one is essential worker. And media is not part of the essential frontline workers. Yeah. We're essential workers, but we're not frontline essential workers.
It doesn't get me in line right now. Heather, it doesn't get me in line right now, though, right?
No.
It will as of Monday, March 29th.
But that's my point.
And I do think it's confusing, but I think I go back to I do think it's been confusing. But it is hard for me to believe that sort of the hospital that has been sort of on the front line of this, especially their managers who have been working with the city and public health officials and anybody who's been listening to this, they were part of a lot of these press conferences. You should know that, or you should be asking the questions at least, hey, we're going to go do this. And you probably know that you're going to get a big fat no if you say you're holding a vaccination event at Trump Tower.
Well, it doesn't help, does it, Lisa, that, I mean, just to stir the pot more, that this Dr. Anoush Ahmed, the chief operating officer, gets his picture taken with Eric Trump and says, just vaccinated Eric Trump, which... he later said it was a joke. I didn't do that. I was just, isn't it ironic? The joke is, here's Eric Trump getting a vaccine. We thought they were anti-vaxxers. So that was his quote-unquote joke. But boy, that sure did not help dispel the notion that they were currying favor.
I thought the Trump family was at least quietly on board with a vaccine.
Well, they're happy to take it. We now know that. But they sure didn't act like that when the vaccine was, when the virus was first hitting. Was it Loretto that also gave, is that where the very first vaccines were given in the city? That was Loretto, right?
Yes.
Speaking of the vaccine, I wanted to go to Naperville for just a minute. I know this happened last Sunday, but it was since our last podcast that they had a rally in Naperville. It was from a dozen school districts throughout Chicagoland, including Naperville, and they want the students to have the opportunity to have 5-day a week in-person learning. So there was hundreds of kids and parents there, and they did this rally down the street in Naperville, and then they had speakers, that sort of thing. And the pictures that were in the Tribune, I counted two of the photographs that ran in my paper, and there were 30 people pictured. 5 of them were wearing masks. And I thought, you guys have got to know that this is for public consumption. This isn't a pro or anti-mask rally. It's a get the kids back in the school rally. And in the school, the kids will have to wear the mask. So damn it, even though you're outdoors, wear the damn mask. If you want to persuade people of anything with your rally, wear the mask. Eric, you wrote about that too, right?
Yes, I did. My column on Wednesday was made exactly that point, which is this is about, it's not, we can debate how important it is to wear a mask when you're outside. And apparently, you know, transmission is not that great when you're outside. And these people were, you know, marching down the street. There weren't that many of them, by the way.
A couple hundred.
Some of the, yeah, maybe a couple hundred at the most. I watched the entire video from the event as well as saw the photos. And given how many school districts were allegedly involved, it wasn't that impressive a turnout. But but be that as it may, you're exactly right. It was the symbolism of these people out there saying, send our kids back to school, while illustrating that they're not taking this virus as seriously as you'd want them to. I mean, I would want those people to be telling me as a parent in Naperville, if I were a Naperville parent who's on the fence about this, I'd say, well, the people who are in favor of going back into school take this virus very seriously, and I can trust them, trust their judgment, because I know they're being cautious. I know they're not being blithe and disregarding the threat. But instead, you're right, half the people, maybe more, didn't have masks on. And it was like, what message is this sending? And I got to say, I heard from a lot of parents in Naperville and in the western suburbs who said they had the exact same thought, which is, who are these people who want to send our kids back to school? Is this, I mean, I think one of the speakers you pointed out is Darren Bailey, the Republican candidate for governor, who just had his campaign kickoff event where no one was wearing masks inside. And so you've got these, it's like part of this movement of people who are downplaying, downgrading, trivializing the virus and the threat of it. And I wouldn't trust them with the fate of my children. If I'm a teacher, I wouldn't trust them that they have my best interests in mind. I don't know what they're about, but it's not.
Well, that Bailey was there makes you wonder if it was really about getting kids in the schools, because he's running for governor. He's 4.5 hours away in downstate Xenia, 400 person population. Not that that matters at all, except it just seems to be odd to haul him all the way up here to tell us about the schools in Naperville. And remember, this is the guy that was dragged off the floor at the bank when the legislature was meeting because he wouldn't wear a mask. They had to haul his butt out of there. It seems to me like those people were brought together maybe in the guise of, hey, let's get the kids back in school. And then he stands up there and runs for governor. Paul Vallis called it a war on our children. He called it a war. Paul Vallis called it a war on children. Lisa, is he running for governor again? Is that what that was?
Well, if you follow him, I don't know. He's going to run for something here, because he spends quite a bit of his time on Twitter hammering, you know, Mayor Lightfoot over everything from how she's overseeing the running of schools to fighting crime. He seems to be hammering away at her. So I sort of question whether he was going to make another run for mayor, but this appearance would suggest that maybe he's dipping his toe again into maybe the gubernatorial pool of candidates.
Heather, am I missing anything in this story?
Nope. Vallis, I think, is a very interesting sort of political evolution story, because if you remember his concession speech when he, in the first round of the 2019 mayoral election, he just lavished praise on Lightfoot, and to the point where we all sort of looked at each other and said, I guess he wants to be her budget director, which is, of course, the post that he held under former Richard M. Daley. And pretty much ever since then, he has been very, very critical of not only her, but also the Chicago Teachers Union, who have had it. So, you know, they've been at odds since he was head of the school district. But, you know, it's hard to remember that he almost defeated Blagojevich for governor. He came within a hair's breadth of being Illinois governor instead of Blagojevich. And isn't that an interesting sliding doors moment of Illinois politics?
Yeah, no kidding.
Bailey has become sort of what the spokesperson for. I mean, he's more aligned with Trump. Let's get the economy going. Let's stay open. I mean, he led some of those lawsuits to keep kind of keep the businesses open. And certainly, I believe he runs a Christian school with his wife downstate Illinois. And they were very much pushing for at least reopening of churches.
Which I have no problem with, Lisa. Like, if he wants to be super pro open up the economy and super pro whatever it is, those are all good planks to run for governor, especially downstate. I just don't know what it has to do with getting kids in Naperville schools. And you know who really has to bear the brunt of that, if you ask me? It's the school boards, who are being told, by golly, we're throwing you out come next election. It's an unpaid position. I'll bet a lot of them would say, fine. You want this job, you take it. But to suggest that they are doing it because they want to wage a war on our kids or they're stupid or they're... Do any of you have friends on school boards? Wow, is that a hard job right now. You cannot win with any decision you make.
I don't think anybody can win in any of this. I don't think the mayor can win. I don't think the governor can win. These are unprecedented times. You do one thing and somebody else is going to get hurt. You close the businesses, you're hurting the economy.
And isn't it all going to hinge the entire governor's race next year? It's all going to hinge on our retrospective judgment of how important it was for J.B. Pritzker to take the steps that he did. And Mayor Lightfoot the year after that will have to answer for her response to the pandemic. So when you're looking, I mean, right now, Pritzker's popularity, and we spoke about this poll last week, it seems to be, you know, kind of low 40s in approval, which is dangerous territory for an incumbent. But and a lot of the criticism is on how he's had the steps he's taken, what he's closed down, what he's opened up, how he's done it, how the Illinois Department of Employment Services has run or not run well, and so on. But that it's all going to hinge on when we look back on this and say, well, did Pritzker do a good job? Were these things that he closed down sensible? Should we have opened schools sooner? And I still think that he may end up looking all right when we're all done with this.
If we're talking about the same poll, that's the Northwestern, the University Consortium poll that you're talking about, Eric?
This was the Republican poll.
There's a consortium of universities that sort of do month-to-month polls looking at all the governors and sort of the number of people who thought he was doing a good job. In May, it was like 63% of voters in Illinois, and now it's down to 46%. But he's right in the middle of the pack. A lot of this has to do with the sort of the waning attention. People are tired of it. They may not be ticked off at him. It doesn't necessarily mean more people are ticked off at what he's doing. They're just sick of the pandemic. And so we see that a lot of governors are kind of in that high 40% range.
Yeah, just because they're there, just because they're the guy. Well, what is the status of his ongoing executive orders? We used to talk about that more in the pandemic, and I know Austin was always upset about that. Does he still have the kind of authority that he had at the beginning of this thing?
Yes, and he reissues them almost like clockwork every 30 days. I keep a close eye on it because of the eviction moratorium. And I think we're coming to sort of a head on that as the national eviction moratorium expires at the end of March. The states right now goes through the first week of April, and I will be interested to see what happens after that national moratorium expires.
I thought that Biden was hinting that he at least in prose and speech and so forth, he was sort of hinting that would continue. Maybe not, because I've not seen anything concrete, but I just feel like in a few of his speeches, he's sort of mentioned we have to protect people from, you know, losing their homes and losing the roof over their head. But I haven't seen anything concrete that way.
Yeah, I think there are two things happening. One, there have been a couple of judges that have struck down the moratorium on different legal grounds, which puts that in a little bit of a little more murky position. Also, there was a significant amount of aid for people struggling to pay their rent and their mortgage, both in the relief package approved in December and then the one that Biden just signed. So there may be some sort of effort to extend the moratorium until that aid gets into people's bank accounts and pockets. But because getting that aid to people is much more complicated than it might seem.
Well, it's impossible to know what the president thinks about it because he hasn't had a press conference since he took office because he's a coward and unpatriotic, and also because he's addled. His mind is gone soft, and he can't talk in front of the press corps anymore.
John, they filled that Rush Limbaugh spot on WLS. You don't have to keep trying.
I think I read something like that in your newspaper, Eric, and it was a different columnist than you, but I don't know how reasonable the criticism is of Joe Biden for not having a presser. Jen Psaki talks every single day. I'd rather her talk than him, to be honest with you.
Well, they do. They reinstated the daily news briefings, and so there is no lack of a flow of information out of the White House. What you're not getting is Biden up there in front of the media. You know, he is... he is kind of a gaffe machine, and I'm sure that his people are concerned about that. He does have a news conference scheduled coming up soon. I don't know the date.
His first one.
So he is going to have one. It's just been a long time. This is one of those stories that I think really obsesses people in maybe in the media and maybe in Washington, but I don't think it's like a kitchen table conversation where people are saying, you know, gosh, well, there's this pandemic, but you know what's really bothering me? Joe Biden hasn't had a news conference. I think it's one of those stories that as soon as he has a news conference, and yeah, he'll say something dumb, he'll forget a name or he'll blow a date, and everyone will say, well, he's completely demented and out of his mind, and then we'll move on.
I still think it's weird that folks are getting away with these kind of criticism. He stutters. He has said that he stutters, and yet still getting mocked. I don't quite understand it.
He hasn't been.
It's important to note that it's not that he hasn't taken any questions from the press conference. Right. He does do what's called gaggles in the business as he leaves for like Marine One, or when he walks by when they do pool sprays in the Oval Office. And I think two things can be true. I think we as journalists can want to have as many press conferences as possible. And I will, in the interest of fully disclosure, worked with Greg Pratt over at the Tribune to basically set up some ground rules for the mayor to reopen her press conferences to more than just one pool reporter and one pool camera. So I feel very strongly about there being access. I also think that I'm a little bit uncomfortable when I see journalists who do not work on the opinion side of things demanding that the president do X or Y. I that makes me uncomfortable.
I don't understand why that bothers you. He's the president.
You're advocating for an elected official to do something rather than merely saying, here's what the elected official is doing.
Oh,
here's the context of what they're doing.
Well, you and I come at it from different perspectives, then, don't we? I'm a talk show host. You're a reporter. I,
yes.
I would happily advocate that the president ought to stand in front of the American people and do what's best, advocate for certain policies or push certain things that are going to make the economy better. But to be honest with you, the fact that, kind of like what Eric was saying, the fact that Joe Biden isn't speaking, you can be critical of that, but it just lowers the temperature, right? There's less to fuss about. He's not going to be a brilliant speaker when he speaks. Let Jen Psaki do the nuts and bolts. And if he's got to do an Oval Office address or the occasional gaggle, swell. But I'm not sitting here going, boy, I wish Joe Biden would get in front of the microphones right now. I don't even think about it.
I would prefer that he did. I prefer that he gave regular, stand-up news conferences and took reporters' questions. I think that's fair. That's part of the job. I understand, I think, why his people are not exposing him to that as much as possible. He did give a speech, what was it, about a week ago, in which he did address the nation. It's not like he's hiding. It's like that they're really carefully limiting the kind of access that he has.
And he got stuff wrong on that speech, too, Eric.
But I don't think it was because he had a...
Not in the speech, but in the ABC interview that he did.
Pardon me. You're absolutely... I'm wrong about him being wrong. It was when he was talking to Stephanopoulos.
It was just exaggerations. It worked. I think the New York Times did some kind of a fact check or the Post, and there were some exaggerations, which I think they're just trying to be fair since there were lots of fact checks with Trump.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if you compare the two, it's still not even close. And one of the... And I don't remember which one it was, but one of the corrections in the Stephanopoulos interview, I went, that's part of the headline? I mean, it seemed rather trivial to me compared to some of the stuff that we'd endured the previous 4 years.
During the mayoral campaign in Chicago, I put a question to all the candidates. I said, will you agree to go on WTTW, Chicago Tonight, Heather's program, once a month? To talk to a panel of journalists to answer questions. And just about every candidate, including Lori Lightfoot, said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And it's not happened. It's never happened. It's like the mayor could easily do that and answer a lot of the questions in front of the public rather than in these limited sessions with just reporters there in a high-profile setting, and they don't want to do it.
I'll toot my own horn and say that we have the mayor on the program tonight. Taping this Thursday afternoon. And I don't know that in the year that I've been at WTTW, I don't think she's ever refused an invitation that we've extended to her. Certainly, there have been timing things and whatnot. And we've certainly wanted more time than we were given. But at least on that, there's been
those are very valuable. I think.
Yes.
You see in the studio, and it's not reporters shouting questions at her.
It's what the governor should do.
Yeah. And there's ample opportunity for follow up. The governor should do it too. So it becomes almost a conversation. We mm-hmm. really get to probe issues, mm-hmm. and I think that's a very important part of being a public servant. And I'm glad to hear that the mayor's going to be on Chicago tonight. And
I mean, and of course, we'd certainly like to have her in person in the studio. You know, sitting across from Paris Schatz or Brandis Friedman, but you know. We're not letting anybody in the studio.
Right oh, really? Now. So she can't come into the Channel 11 right. studios?
Right. All of it's via Zoom. And because of the pandemic, but also because we're building a new studio, which is exciting.
The News Click question we posted to our listeners was, do you think that the city and state, now let's just say the state, I don't remember exactly how it was put, but anyway, are we opening up too quickly? The schools, the sports venues, restaurants and bars, I mean, phase five is right there. They didn't say we're going there today, but you can just see how much more liberal we're getting with the policy. So we asked our listeners, how do you feel about that? Are you getting nervous? Are we maybe now sprinting at the end and we should be still going cautiously? And it was a third, a third, a third. Yes, no, and maybe.
Yes, I think we are going a little too fast because I think we're very close to having the number of people vaccinated that will make opening up much safer. I would just like to see a little bit more of a delay, a little bit more caution right now, make sure we get things under control, because I think then opening up is going to be more successful.
And Heather, Chicago is not included in what they were talking about today anyway, right?
So, no. The mayor is going to, at some point in the next couple of days, release the Chicago reopening plan, sort of to bridge between phase four and phase five. But Chicago's also not included in the everyone will be eligible for a vaccine by April 12th that the governor announced today. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, simply because, you know, Chicago has its own supply of vaccine directly from the federal government, and it faces a lot of different issues and concerns than the rest of the state. So the city and the state have been almost closely aligned, but on, you know, a number of key issues, there have been stark deviations, and it'll be interesting to see how closely the mayor's plan aligns with the governor's bridge plan that we just heard about today.
So a lot different in Illinois than it is in other states still. Somebody sent me a joke this week. Texas has now opened up the peeing section in swimming pools, too. It's just wide open there. I wanted to talk to you guys about the stimulus checks, which rolled into people's accounts this week. We asked our listeners to tell us, what are you going to do with the money? And it was really, really fun. You know, I mean, everything from a lot of people are going to go buy some pot, you know, and then other people. One woman said that she's going to continue to pay on the 2-carat diamond ring that her husband got her for their 50-year anniversary. So they're still paying on their diamond ring. And then people roll their eyes. They get exasperated. You're spending the stimulus on marijuana and diamond rings. That's not what it's about. And I think it's absolutely what it's about if you sell diamond rings and if you sell marijuana. It's, you know, I don't have much patience for people judging how people spend their stimulus. The biggest sin, I believe, is to not spend it at all.
I don't necessarily think it's a sin to save it either. I think you pay off your bills and you save it. That's always the advice that I've been given for something that you want to do. Mm-hmm. Or to help people. And I think that's also in order. I've been saying all along that I think maybe the income threshold is a bit high for these things and that they could lower it, maybe give people more money, which I still hope that they'll do if there's another round.
I bet there won't be, Lisa.
Yeah, I don't think so either. So it's incumbent on all of us who maybe have paid off those bills that we needed to pay or whatever else and can spare some to the greater Chicago Food Depository. There are a lot of people hurting in this city.
It's interesting to me, too, that, you know, the threshold is 75, but cuts off at 80. So last year, or say in 2019, depending on whether or not you filed your 2020 income taxes, but you could have earned $60,000 and or say in the last year, your income went from $60,000 to $74,000, that in fact in 2020, you did better. You actually made more money because maybe your business catered to people that were, you know, feeling the pressures of COVID-19 and you were able to capitalize on that. So now you made even more money last year. But if you're below 74, even though you got more money, we're going to give you more money because you're below 74. If, however, in that year, you'd gone from $150,000 a year in income to $82,000, you know, your income was cut in half. You get nothing. You know, you got a mortgage, no sin in that. You're sending your kids to school or you're driving a car, whatever it is your lifestyle is. And now it's cut in half and we give you absolutely nothing. I've heard from those people too. Lady said to me today, I make $160,000 a year with my husband. We are not rich. We may have more than you, but we're not rich and we get nothing. And there's some resentment out there about the way that whole thing was structured.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly heard that kind of resentment. On the other hand, I think if you're making $160,000 a year, you're not in need of a lifeline thrown to you by the government. I mean, this is supposed to be relief. It's not really supposed to be a stimulus.
Oh, really? Because it's called a stimulus, Eric.
Well, I read it as
technically, everybody's been calling it a stimulus, but it's a relief payment.
Well, I didn't ask you, Heather.
The American Rescue Plan.
is that just envy from somebody making $160,000 a year and they want their
maybe
$1,400 each? I mean, that's not what this is about. You know, the government is not just supposed to be just handing out money to people who want it. This is supposed to be something that's going to keep people in their homes, keep people in their cars, let kids stay in their schools, and keep, you know, from accumulating huge interest payments on their debt, things like that. I don't think it's meant to, like, I mean, it's fine. You're right. It's fine if people buy diamond rings or marijuana, but that's, it really is about making, keeping people from, you know, keeping the wolves away from the door, which I totally support that. I support, you know, people getting payments to stay to pay rent and buy food and things like that, pay tuition. But, you know, the purpose of this entire rescue package is, as it's called, it's a rescue package. It's not supposed to just be jumpstarting the economy by helping diamond dealers.
You know, another thing that we asked about was would you jump the line, or how do you feel about the people that are quote unquote jumping the line in the vaccine queue out there? I heard from a woman today, she has relatives who are in their 40s. Their kid is in his 20s, and they figured out how to get the vaccine. Her husband is 69, and he can't seem to figure out how to get the vaccine. And she asked him, how did you do it? And they said, well, you just got to figure the system out. And that was really upsetting to her, especially coming from family.
Two things can be true at the same time. One, as many people should get the vaccine as quickly as possible. And the fact is that there are some people who are more likely to suffer severe illness and death from COVID, and that those people should get access to the limited supply of vaccines before people like me, who, if I get COVID, chances are I would weather it pretty well. But it's hard because there is no perfect solution. There is no perfect thing. There is no perfect way to do that. And as we talked about before, all of the rules and all of the restrictions, plus that limited supply, is enough to make a person crazy. My husband hasn't gotten the vaccine and he's potentially at greater risk. And, you know, I've been waiting with bated breath for the next phase to open for him. Do I have that human reaction when I see a Wrigleyville bro posting that he got the vaccine and he's 25? It's infuriating. I mean, I'm human, but him getting the vaccine is a good thing, even if I can wish that he would have waited.
Yeah, because he's going to be circulating, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, is the question how the line is constructed, John, or is the question people who are jumping in, who are cheating and jumping in the line? Because I feel a lot of anger and contempt for people who are cheating, who are say, lying about their medical condition or lying about their employment condition to get a vaccine when they don't deserve it. That's not fair. And but if someone, if your 25-year-old Wrigleyville bro is a paramedic or something like that, I think that makes sense to me.
Well, that's also part of the issue, because social media, if I see a picture of him holding up his vaccine card, like in Wrigleyville, slamming a Malort shot, I don't know that he's a paramedic. And I might assume that he did cheat when he didn't cheat. And he's just celebrating where he is in line. And I think that that can be sort of a damaging circle of events where people get more frustrated because they only see that snapshot.
But I think in your scenario, Heather, he's not an EMT.
Probably not, but it is better for my mental health to say, you know what, maybe he qualified in a different way that I can't see. So I will wish him all the best and go back to trying to find an appointment.
Well, he's one less person to spread the virus. Right. I was at the Walgreens the other day. They had the little check-in station for people getting the vaccine. Saw three people go in. Not one of them was 50 years old. One of them was a teenager, and she was with her mom. I presume she was over 16 or 18. One was a lady about, I'm going to guess, 35. Another one was a guy about 45. And maybe they all had underlying conditions and it was legit. But I was getting the feeling that these people just figured out, even though they're not 65 and we were in Cook County, they figured out how to get the vaccine. And I've had people whisper to me, hey, listen, I'm going to hook you up.
I mean, and this leads me into another conversation. What's really galling to me are the people who do have the opportunity to take the vaccine and are refusing it. We saw a story in the Tribune earlier this week about something like half of the people who work in correctional facilities, prisons and jails, are declining the vaccine. My wife was at the hospital today getting a test, and she had two of the techs who were working with them said they had refused the vaccine. Not that they hadn't yet been offered it, but they had refused it. And to me, that's just really irresponsible. And really, I'm much more upset about that than I am about your Wrigleyville bro and his shot on the Lord.
Military, too, Eric. Military personnel, very most unlikely to get the vaccine.
To take the vaccine.
They're offered it, but to take it.
I'm really getting into the no jab, no job camp, where if you don't get a vaccine and you've got a job that makes it that you deal with the public and you won't get a vaccine, then we'll put you on, you know, desk duty, as they say in the police department, or, you know, you can't come in until you get your vaccine. Private companies have every right to do that, and I hope that they start doing it.
I don't have a logical segue to the Grammys. Did you watch the Grammys, Eric?
I watched the controversial portion of the Grammys.
Go ahead and tell us about that, Eric.
Well, I mean, the controversy part was where Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion sang the song WAP. And it was, as someone pointed out, it looked a lot like an act you might see at a gentleman's nightclub. And this created the story of the week. Now that Fox News has moved on from Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head, now they've got the WAP song and the performance on the Grammys, which was, you know, people are saying that it's highly inappropriate for a network TV broadcast at that time of night. I guess I would agree with that. It was fairly raunchy. And it's one of those things where I saw and I went, oh, geez, this is just more red meat to throw out in the culture wars.
Lisa, what was your reaction to it?
I was in, I don't know, I think third grade or second grade when I got an 8-track with that Donna Summer song. What was it? Bad Girl?
Love to Love You, Baby?
Yeah, I think it was Donna Summer. It was like Bad Girl. And I was like, what is it? What's she in trouble for? You know, and then like a couple years later, I realized, oh, okay. So I don't know if this is something that's more sexualized than ever before. I just think we get to maybe see it on our TVs more. But I see it as more sexual freedom, frankly, than, say, you know, somebody maybe singing about having to be a prostitute. You're probably not going to get a lot of shock and, oh, my God, from me. I probably wouldn't want maybe my nieces who I wouldn't want to have to explain some of the stuff to, so I could see, you know, if you don't want your younger kids to see it because you don't want to maybe have to have that conversation yet.
So we have two girls who are 11 and 8, and we let them stay up on New Year's Eve until midnight for the first time this year. And we were watching like the New Year's Rocking Eve or whatever. And Megan Thee Stallion was one of the performers, and her performance was not what she did at the Grammys, but she was still relatively naked and she was, you know, dancing in a grown-up sort of way. And both of my girls thought it was A, hilarious, and B, have been making jokes since then about people doing butt dances. So I do not think that their poor minds have been warped or terrible things have happened to them. And there's something to be said that discussions about the way that Black women in particular perform in public and women in general perform in public are discussions that for my entire life and my mom's entire life and my grandmother's entire life have been really coded discussions about women's rights to their sexuality and their autonomy. And so much of what has been said about Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion is a coded discussion about racism and misogyny, and has nothing to do with actually them or wanting to protect children. And it is one of those cultural freakouts that is much ado about nothing.
I guess I didn't think about that because I was sort of thinking, I was ticking through all of the women, Madonna, all of these people who have sort of felt liberated in their lives. And I saw this as another, you know, this is the 2021 version of this sort of liberation.
This is the VMA kiss.
It's a good point. It's a good point about the coded discussion and the racism that it's underlying everything.
Yep.
So do you see it as an empowering act, as an empowering moment on that broadcast, or as sort of degrading or
I don't think it's either. I think you can see it purely as a person whose job is to sell music and videos and merchandise and saying that's how they're trying to sell you what they are selling. And I don't think that it is inherently empowering or degrading. As a culture, I don't know that we can talk about this without first grappling with the fact that people see Black women expressing their sexuality as a threat. And I don't, you know what I mean? I don't know how you can separate any sort of well-meaning discussion about kids or vulgarity or empowerment from that.
But there was a freak out when, was it who kissed?
Was it Britney Spears?
Yeah, having a kiss. And people freaked out about that. Those are two white women. There's a lot, and of course, this goes back a long time now, but Madonna had people all tied up in knots, so to speak, during her career.
And that obviously is not so much about racism, but it's full stop about misogyny. And if white women are subject to misogyny, Black women are subject to a level of misogyny that, you know, exceeds that by several factors of magnitude. And I think it's disingenuous for people to talk about it being somehow race neutral in this case, because it's just not. These freakouts come every so often as the culture tries to push back on what they see as the realm of acceptable behavior for women in public.
Yeah, I don't know. But I see also there was controversy about Miley Cyrus too.
You're getting on all the right things. Women. This is the big freak out about women.
I
guess I probably am projecting, but I hope that it is Cardi B's kind of big middle finger to she's very bold to me, and I kind of hope she is sort of trying to grab a little power here and say, this is what I'm doing. You know, it's to sell things, but it's also, to me, it is sort of inherently empowering to sort of be out there and be the one sort of expressing this without sort of surrounded by a bunch of men, just to be out there as a woman and doing this.
Is there a male equivalent of this? I mean, Prince was fairly sexualized.
I brought it up to my son and he said, well, this was Elvis 1,000 years ago and this conversation hasn't changed. And I thought, I think it has though. Like Elvis was swiveling his hips and people thought that was too sexual and they had to shoot him from the waist up and all of that jazz. But this is on a magnitude of something completely different. It just looked so fantastically different, what I saw, compared to some of these other things, including the Madonna and Britney kiss, that I thought, okay, well, then what would be so low that it would be a degradement to women, or that it would be counter to the message of we're empowering ourselves. See, we get to do whatever we want. Like, I guess you can just do anything.
Yeah, I think it's worth for the people like you who found it like disturbing and, you know, a new low is to sort of examine why. Any sort of honest assessment of that, you know, has to grapple with the fact that these were two Black women, that these were at least one woman who has a history that she is not ashamed of working as a stripper and who proclaims that. And you also have the other woman involved with this was the victim of domestic violence and has talked extensively about how her public persona is informed by the racism and the misogyny that she confronts. I think that's all part of it.
Okay, but as an entertainer, if I was going to say, listen, I'm not going to be an object of sexuality, I'm going to be an artist and I'm going to sing or dance and I've got a message and I've got a talent and I'm going to display it. One way to ask you to accept me on those terms would not be to sell my body or my nudity or my sexuality. And so maybe like you say, you get to do both, but then I think it's fair to have both reactions because isn't it fair to say one way to express that, hey, I'm owning my own space here. You're not going to define me is to stop defining yourself the way you've been objectified for years and years and years and years. Don't sell the sex. Show me something else about your artistry that's meritorious of an award or being on TV.
I think the problem with that is that the who determines what is meritorious and who determines what is worthy.
I do. The consumer does. Anybody does. You do.
No, I don't
Black
think
people
it's the consumer. I think we have to realize that we live in a society where there is systemic racism. And I think one way people in marginalized communities express their reaction and rejection of that systemic racism is to turn what is considered low class or inappropriate and to turn that on its head and to claim that. And I think that the reaction where the dominant culture says, well, that's just low class, that's unacceptable, that's degrading, I think that's sort of the point.
Maybe it is. Maybe it's more clever than I know. But I think I would have that reaction, were they white or were they men? I think a lot of people didn't like it when Michael Jackson was grabbing his crotch. Or I'm trying to think now of some inappropriate behavior we didn't like from white guys on TV, too.
Well, I would suggest that any inappropriate behavior on white guys was greeted significantly with less pearl clutching than so-called inappropriate behavior.
Okay,
by
but then are you saying that anything is I hate to say okay, because of course you can do whatever you want. It's okay. When we're watching it on TV, we're going, what are we looking at? What is this?
I mean, nobody's forcing you to watch it. A, you could have turned it off. You're entitled to write a letter to CBS expressing your displeasure yes. about what you were forced to endure.
So when you talk to your daughters about that, and you say they just laughed it off. Maybe they didn't, by the way.
Yeah.
Maybe that will haunt you someday. Maybe it won't. But I mean, you had no more of a conversation about it with your daughters
I'm a big fan of the parenting technique in which I answer questions in which I am that with
understood.
That I'm
okay, but so, I think that ignores the possibility that they might be absorbing it or processing it in ways that you don't know.
They are, but I trust them to process it. Because they've got good heads on their shoulders and I trust them to process it. And I trust that if they reach sort of a wall where they're having trouble struggling with it, to reach out to people that can help them, including me and other people in their lives.
So then, if judging that, they said, but you know what, Mom, we thought that was awesome. They were empowering. And now I'm going to dance that way too. And that's going to be at the junior high talent show.
And I would say, you know what, here are the rules. Are you following the rules? Are you dressed according to the dress code?
Eric, you were going to say something.
Well, I actually wanted to ask Heather if she feels like this sort of presentation, if she let her girls watch, if they did watch it, does this contribute to the objectification of women, the sexualization of women in a way that as John is saying, it sort of almost detracts from the message that they are extremely talented vocalists and songwriters and so on, and that it encourages that which we say that we are trying to tamp down.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question, and it's a good one. But I also just think it's part of the culture. And I think that it's problematic when people tell other people how to express their own empowerment.
Well, nobody was restricting them, though. They were on TV. You know, they're profiting from it. So,
yeah, this was not a wardrobe malfunction. This was something that CBS knew was going to happen.
Right.
I'm sure they thought through all the reactions they were going to get. And they said, yeah, let's do this.
And, you know, it's supposed to be a rock and roll awards show, although I'm sure the rock and roll critics would tell us that train left the station a long time ago. But whatever that is, of course, the old people, the fuddy-duddies, the fussy folks are going to take issue with the way they were dancing and twerking on the TV. And I was talking to my wife. I said, you know, honey, just because I have that reaction doesn't mean we're wrong. I guess that's the point I started to make here, Eric, when you first brought it up. And I would hope, Heather, that at least you would allow that.
Oh, sure.
That doesn't make me a sexist or a racist that I found that offensive.
No, but I think, you know, part of what I would hope that we come out of this pandemic and sort of the social justice protests over the summer is that we each interrogate our own personal reactions to things, because it comes from somewhere. And I think that it's important to sort of interrogate why we react the way that we react. We may say, yeah, no, I understand where it's coming from. And that's, I'm okay with that. I'm going to stand by that. But I think so much of what, you know, sort of exists in our society is sort of this reflexive sort of, well, that's just how I think about it. And I'm not going to think more deeply about it or examine about those disparities or look differently and try to attack sort of the root of that reaction.
I guess at the end of the day, I just wish there was a way to know or to score if that was them intellectually owning their sexuality and saying, yeah, I'm going to do it just to thumb my nose at you guys and express my strength, or if it was just a sellout, or if it was just their inability to do that. Now Lisa's smiling at me, but that's...
No, I just think that all art is how we sort of interpret it. No, I'm just smiling because of that. I'm not making fun of what you're saying. I just sort of, I think I was sort of stunned by the shock of it. So then I have to go back and check myself.
I know. That's, you know, if I'm nothing like, oh, else, really? We've just sold more units for him because people are going to go, I got to go back and look at that thing again. Are you kidding me?
Sometimes, though, John, do you find that you're, instead of actually personally reacting yourself, you're sort of reacting by proxy?
I am.
And as I said, when I answered the first question about this, I was thinking, like, my thought wasn't, I find this offensive. It was, oh, no, the entire right-wing freakout machine yeah. is going to find this offensive. We're going to have a whole thing about this all week over this.
You did put it that way, Eric.
That's what bothered me about it. Was like, this is just like another shot fired in the culture.
Well, I didn't think it in terms of left-right as much as old-young or maybe male-female or white-black or some confluence of all of those. But, Eric, you would, of course, wonder what the right wing is going to say and how they're going to blow it up for a week. I didn't think about it in those terms. I was just feeling very old watching it. You know, I thought, okay, boy, I'm really missing this. I'm sure if I were something I ain't, you know, it's a 61-year-old white guy, that I would be reacting differently to this, but it sure isn't for me. I was feeling out.
It was on well after your bedtime.
The very fact that we were up watching it while playing backgammon, I might add, should tell you everything that you need to know about us. Guys, we spent a lot of time on that. I'm glad you brought it up, Eric, I think. What else? And by the way, one other thing that we didn't talk about was the serial stowaway, Marilyn Hartman, who... I was kind of glad, and I shouldn't say this because I don't want people picking on me when I'm not represented in a conversation on another station, but Channel 2 sure thought they had the score. And then at the end they said, remember, she's gotten a year's and a half worth of counseling and medicine and institutionalization, so she's okay to go now. They let her out, and 2 days later she's back at O'Hare again. We were going to put Brad Edwards on, the anchor at Channel 2. They reached out to us and said, hey, how about Brad? Come on and talk about the series. And we said, okay, but I'm not sure that I love this series. And I think what that message is, this is a mentally ill woman who's inadvertently told us how vulnerable or porous our airports still are. That's all.
I think so, too.
That's all there is.
TSA ought to hire her in some capacity, you know, also understanding that there are mental health issues here. So
And it's not clear to me that she necessarily, I mean, she consented to these interviews, but I don't know if she is capable of understanding what it would be like to be publicized. I doubt there's a coincidence, the fact that that stuff aired on Channel 2 and then 2 days later she's found at the airport. She's a clearly mentally ill and fragile person, and this story just makes me sad.
She appeared in bond court this afternoon, and her attorney blamed CBS too. They said that the show triggered her mental illness and sort of caused her to act out again. Obviously, that's what, you know, the defense attorney is going to argue. But I think in general, the news media does a poor job of assessing when they interview and spotlight somebody who is obviously struggling with mental illness for ratings. And I love the folks over at CBS too, but they hyped the story as being post Super Bowl.
Yep.
They promoted it. And I think the question is, did they do so at the expense of a vulnerable person suffering from mental illness? And I don't know the answer to that
question. I don't know that she saw the promos, but they did run a series of these 5-second sound bites where she was just saying stuff. And it was kind of intriguing, but it was also kind of icky. And I thought, oh, that's a good get. No, wait, that's a terrible get. You guys shouldn't be doing this. I was on
that. Was my reaction as well.
Yeah.
I mean, at first, when he's like, oh, there's this old woman and she's snuck onto airplanes and flown to London and so on. You think, oh, that's funny. That's a talker. But as this keeps happening and as this story goes on, it's clearly a tragic story. And again, I felt the same way you did about the Channel 2 hyping it and promoting this interview.
And shortly after she got arrested, they had no interest in doing promotional interviews. You know, like you could have gone back on a line, or maybe they were going to do a follow up. They didn't want to have anything to do with that story after she got arrested the second time. And Mary Mitchell's piece in the Sun Times was kind of interesting. She said, "It wasn't now you know how we feel, but the idea that." This little old white woman goes to the airport and she says, oh, you know, can I just follow that man with the briefcase? I'm with him. And they say, okay, come right through. She said, what do you think the chances are that I, as a black female, am going to get that pass, let alone anybody else? So she saw it in racial terms and put it that way.
I think she's probably right, though.
Oh, yeah.
100%. Yeah. I also think there's an argument to be made about how older white women can be invisible. And I'm reminded of a story that the great Linda Lutton did over at WBEZ about a pair of women who changed the sign for Douglas Park to Douglas with two S's. And they pretended to be like art observers when like police and people rolled by and said, what are you doing? And they just were like, okay, nice job, little ladies, and rolled on.
I heard the promos and I missed it because it's been a kind of a busy stretch. Well, for everybody here, and I did not see the interview. But I do want to hear from her in some way. And I hope that doesn't make me insensitive. I just want to understand. It's not in any kind of like, ooh, you know, I just want to understand her. I want to hear her voice. I want to know what's going on.
Well, she got on 30 times. She was able to get through 30 times. Yeah. And they didn't explain how she did it 30 times. I know once or twice she said, I'm with that man. But literally, what was her method? I don't think the series really gave us a full explanation of how that happened. They were just more selling, hey, guess who we got? And isn't she an interesting story? And at the end of the day, Lisa, I don't think she was, because she wasn't well.
It reminds me a little bit of the stories about Vincent Richardson, the young man who's been apprehended many times impersonating a Chicago police officer since he was a kid. And there's a sense we talk about that story, and it's kind of wacky, and he's a mischief maker. But there's something at the heart of that story that, again, is very troubling. There's something wrong with this person, this young man who has basically ruined his own life through this obsession with being a police officer, and continues to do so. It's not just like normal goofy behavior, but again, something that we need to be careful about how we write about it and how we regard
it. And it makes you wonder too, Eric, what should we do?
People have been fairly respectful of that. I was a reporter at the Sun Times at the time when it first happened, and I remember there being more of a discussion about the security breach Like, he was 14, you guys, and he reported for duty.
As a CPD.
And there was a commander. I'm not sure how high up that commander, or at least some white shirt, who said, all right, here are the keys to the squad car. And a question, like, does everybody know who their people are who are reporting for duty? This kid was 14.
And, of course, this other story raises a lot of questions about airport security, too. Yeah. So it is, I mean, it is a legitimate story to worry about, but it's how we talk about.
No, exactly. No, that's what I'm saying. It was more focused on the breach than people sort of chuckled at the foolishness of the security breach. But I don't know that I think people recognized right away that maybe there was something wrong.
Interesting point. Lisa Donovan from the Chicago Tribune. Eric Zorn works there, too. And over at WTTW, Heather Sharon. Okay, guys, that wraps it up for this week. Thanks for being part of the podcast. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Olive Garris. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.